Tonight we will finish if we have to stay here to midnight, but I think we'll be through at 8:30. We will finish Revelation 14. Y'all keep getting me off on sidetracks, but tonight we're going to stay fairly well focused. Any questions so far from last week's discussion? By the way, Barbara, the rules are, feel free to say anything. I never embarrass one human being when they oppose what I say, so feel free to speak up. Okay, any questions? Okay. As I think when we finish the third angel's message tonight, that we need to be aware that there aren't too many major things in life that we have a choice in. We have no choice if we're born male or female. We have no choice on what country we're born in. We have no choice on what ethnicity that we are. There's just lots of things in life that we have no choice. Circumstances push us in one or other direction. We have no choice if we were born rich or born poor. We have no choice if we were born of educated or uneducated mother and father. And so a lot of times we go through life and we hear, well, it's just not fair, or things were working against me. Isn't it ironic that even though in this life we do not have a lot of major choices that affect us, but the one great thing that we do have a choice is where we will spend eternity. And God has given us that choice. So it makes no difference if we're rich or poor, born in what country, what color, what language, what situation. We each have the privilege of making the choice of where we will spend eternity. And that's good news. This book of Revelation is good news. It spells out, especially in Revelation 14, those that make a good choice, and what happens to those that make a bad choice. And the book, the 66 books of the Bible, are illustrations all the way through of people that make very good choices for eternity or very bad choices. So thus it becomes a lesson book. So as tonight when we look at the third message, the third angel's message, let's keep that in mind, that this is about a choice. We make the choice where to spend eternity. The good news is God pulls, draws, begs, gives evidence, pleads, whatever word you want to use, to draw us to spend eternity with Him. So let's start with somebody with verse 9. 14:9.
I noticed a third angel flying behind the first and second ones, and he also gave his message in a loud voice for all to hear, saying, those who worship the sea beast and its image and agree to receive the mark of its name on his forehead or on his hand will have to drink the wine of God's judgment, which will be poured out unmixed with mercy from the cup of his indignation. This will take place in the presence of the holy angels of the Lamb.
Okay, now let's... Last week we spent time, so let's go through it one more time very quickly. What did we decide that mark was? What does mark signify? Those who are redeemed have a mark. Those who are not redeemed or choose to be in rebellion have a mark. What does mark signify?
It's their choice, but they're chosen.
Okay. Any other comments?
Ownership.
Pardon?
Ownership.
Pardon me?
Ownership.
Ownership, okay. Like that. I'm a hard, little hard, seriously, I'm a little hard here. Ownership.
Who you give your allegiance to.
Who you give your allegiance. When you're so settled into the truth or the untruth that you cannot be moved. That is the mark. So thus ownership, allegiance, who you worship, all comes in the same. The people on the side of God will be so settled in the truth about Him that no matter what happens, their allegiance will not be moved. Conversely, though it doesn't make sense, those that are so settled against God, no matter what happens, their allegiance will not change. One of the greatest ways of looking at it is look at what happened to the cross. You would think that as people watch the Savior die, the kindness, the mercy, the thoughts He had, He prayed for forgiveness, He asked for His mom to be remembered, He was kind to one thief, He never uttered a word, but those that were so settled against Him, the cross did not move them. Those that looked to the cross with an open mind, the Roman centurion, Simon who had the privilege, not at the time he didn't know it, of carrying Christ's cross. He was an unbeliever up till then. The thief on the cross and many others, they looked, beheld, and believed. So that is the mark. Wrath of God poured out. What did we discuss last week, especially in light of Romans 1? In the Old Testament, what is God's wrath? In Romans 1, what is God's wrath?
He just let us go. We determined to do our own thing. And
he says, I have to give it up. That's right. Paul says three times, God's wrath is letting us go, giving us up. We make a choice, He does all He can, and when nothing else can move, then He has to sadly say, I must let you go, suffer the consequences of the decisions that you've made. So this is not a God who arbitrarily just says, you've done mad, you're not like, I'm mad at you, I'm going to punish you. That's not the way God works. Okay, let's move on now to the next verse, verse 11.
And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast in his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name.
Okay. In that verse, what do you think the key word is to you?
Torture.
Pardon?
I don't know. The smoke of their torture he's got here, this guy. Rises forever and ever.
Okay.
If it's torture, it's not discipline, is it?
No.
It's a big difference.
And what do you think that difference is?
Well, if it's discipline, you got a chance to change. If it's torture, you have no chance to change.
Okay. Can discipline be given without love?
Yeah, that's for sure.
What's the purpose of discipline?
All right, that's a good question. What's the answer?
Hopefully, it'll make a change.
Discipline means to teach. Well, if you look at the word discipline and the word disciple, it's the same root. And so, when we discipline, it's to disciple somebody. It's to lead them in the right way.
Okay. All right. So, does God discipline us?
Well, He does, but in this case, this right here is not discipline.
Okay.
This is making it safe for the people who are righteous.
Okay. What do we do? By the way, that's still not the key word I'm looking for, but since we're there, let's get on it. What do you do with this that it goes up forever and ever and a few more forevers? What does that mean?
Well, I'm always interested to look on the internet to see what people say about verses like this.
Okay.
Man, you find a lot of them that come up here very emphatic. This is proof that people will be tortured in hell forever, and you will be able to see those people being tortured for what they did to you. That's diabolical. there's a lot of them out there preaching.
Okay.
That wouldn't be pleasant at all, would it? That concept of heaven doesn't sound pleasant to me.
Okay.
Is the key word worship?
No, let's go back to stay on forever and ever for a little
forever
bit, and we'll get to that.
I guess if you go back to the original on that, there is no word for infinity in the Greek, and so they just say forever and ever.
Yeah,
until it's completed.
Yeah, Sodom and Gomorrah is burning forever and ever, but it's still not burning today. It is complete.
Complete destruction.
What picture do you think people have? And there's a lot of nice, of good churches, well-meaning. What picture of God do you think it would present if He actually burned people in hell forever and ever, which lots of churches believe and teach?
They try and scare you out of hell.
Well, then the accusations the devil made about God would be true, I would think, because God is a God of love, and it's not love to keep you going forever and ever suffering.
Okay.
That's not love.
Okay.
When I first heard these preaching, when I was a little boy, I was a Baptist minister, and I'd go home literally fearing, crying for the rest of my eternity in fire that was burning me up. I'd have nightmares at night about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did learn, though, that forever meant consumed away forever. You'd be gone forever. That's what they're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
No more.
Yeah.
No more.
Yeah.
No more.
We do understand that most of Christianity do believe that you do burn in hell forever and ever.
That's right.
So if you, a person said, if God is really like that, and I don't want anything to do with Him, what would be your rebuttal if you believed that you died and burned forever in hell? What would be your rebuttal?
What they say is, well, you only burn for as long as you deserve.
Okay.
That's what they say to you. Because I've said that to people.
Yeah.
That was their response. Well, you only burn as long as you deserve. Well,
okay.
I don't even want to burn that long. So.
Okay. What would you say about a God then that would burn some for a week and some for a year and some for 30 years and Mr. Hitler for hundreds of years?
That's not my God. That's all I can say.
Who would want to spend eternity with Him?
Well, that's it. Truthfully.
Truthfully.
Truthfully. I had a theology teacher that was raised in the Holiness Church, and he said that this is what always bothered him, and that he didn't know if they were trying to scare him out of hell or just scare the hell out of him, he said.
I believe that this is one of the reasons Jesus came to this earth to begin with. Now, remember that when John is writing this, in fact, this, the only thing they had was the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And between the Old Testament and the New was the Apocrypha. And these kind of words are just written in the writings of Enoch and the Strauss. Man, just read so many places in there where they come up with this finish that you get to watch your enemies burn in hell forever. And Christ knew this when He got here.
Mm-hmm.
Here these people were living on the words from as I say, the books of Enoch and Esdras. And he says, he's got to change that attitude, that idea of God. And he spent his life changing that attitude.
Yes.
Is this
in Ecclesiastes, it says it'd be consumed away, never have another part of anything on this earth. Or Ecclesiastes 9:5.
Mm-hmm. Is this an incorrect translation from the original, forever and ever? Because when the first translations came into being, that was one of the new beliefs that had arisen in the church.
I think the word is in there is forever. But again, you have to, you know, read in context with all the others. That's why it's important to not take one text and put everything on it. You have to keep it into context. If we're not comfortable with a God who would burn somebody in hell for eternity, then are we supposed to be God satisfied with a God who says, if you disobey me, then I will arbitrarily kill you? Is there much different? Why we must understand that when a person chooses to separate themselves from God, and that is the choice, you're either for God or you're against God. There is no middle road. When you choose to go against God, the natural consequences of that decision is that you will be cut off from the life source and you will die. It's not God arbitrarily saying, I'm going to punish you. It's just a natural consequence of being separated from God. Now, let's go to the key word in verse 11.
I'd say no rest.
No rest. Why would you say that, Leroy?
Well, because without God, there is no rest. I mean, can you feature what a life would be without God?
Okay.
You would be in emotionally turmoil all the time. Look at the people on this world today that have no use for God, and they're grasping for anything they can, and end up with drugs, with wars, with all kind of bad things that we say is bad, because they have no.
Okay.
We have no rest in God.
Okay, just hold that thought. We're coming back to it. Somebody read now the last verse 13. Remember, the wicked have no rest from God. Now somebody read 14:13.
Then I heard a voice from heaven say, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on.
Keep going.
Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labor, for their deeds will follow them.
All right. So now we have a contrast. Here we have wicked, who have what? No rest. The redeemed have what?
Rest.
In the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, a definition for wickedness, does anybody remember? Restlessness. Restlessness. In context, do you see when Daniel said in 12:4 that men run to and fro? We say, well, they're looking for the knowledge, and knowledge will be increased, and men will run to and fro. We say, well, look at all the great inventions. That's not what that text is saying. It's talking about restlessness. You will run to and fro trying to find answers. Now, one of the best texts to understand that, and let's all turn, if you would be kind enough, to Hebrews, the 4th chapter. Hebrews 4, and I'm going to read 9, 10, and 11. Is everybody there? Hebrews 4, 9. There remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from his. Let us therefore be diligently to enter into that rest, lest anyone fall through the following of the same example of disobedience. Normally, what do we use this as a proof text for?
Sabbath day.
Sabbath day.
Yeah.
There's no way in the world this particular text can be used as a proof text for Sabbath, because that is not what this text is talking about whatsoever. Not so ever. So what is it talking about? Therefore remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered into his rest has himself also rested from what type of works? His works. What's this talking about? Pardon?
It would be creation, wouldn't it? His work?
Salvation by works.
Absolutely not creation, and absolutely salvation by works. Any other attempt to get to heaven except through the graciousness of God is salvation by works. Now, we talked about people that are unrest, and Leroy said exactly correct. Look at the people who are on drugs. Look at the people who do all of these things. And those are easy to point out. I want to show you another group of people that have unrest. And those are churchgoers who feel like they are so good and so close to God, and they keep everything that God wants, and they look around and they find people, other around them, and say, look at these poor slobs who are not good Christians. That's as high of an unrest in your relationship with the Father as the person that goes and shoots cocaine. And the greatest example in the New Testament is who? Or what group?
Israelites?
The Pharisees.
They spent their entire life working by obedience and following rules and making rules to interpret the rules, so there would be no misunderstanding on what rule they were trying to keep. And they had as much unrest as the drug addict does. Because anything, any attempt to get to heaven outside of the goodness and the graciousness of God is salvation by works. And there is no rest. Some of the most... we're recording this. I know some people that were very close to me that were good churchgoers in the Seventh-day Adventist Church and went through a legalistic period of life, and they were the most unhappiest Christians you could be around. And so that's as much as unrest as it can be.
There's another type of unrest going on too, Ernie. We can see it today. Sandy's going to tell you this story because I don't hear good enough to do it, but she had a patient this week who is experiencing this worshipful unrest. Tell them about that lady she's telling me about.
Well, you know, I ask patients if they have support systems and if they have a faith background or something like that. And this lady told me that she was Catholic. She had early years of being Baptist. But she said, I quit going to church because the church has changed so much. And when I go in, I want to feel like I'm in the presence of God. And when I go, she said, my husband died a few years ago. And I wanted to go to church, and I went to church, and I wanted it to be, you know, soothing and love and all that helps. And she didn't experience that. She said everything was happy and praise and excited and all this. She said, man, I didn't feel like that, and I haven't gone back. And
I told her I really think that that heart worship and what I call kind of superficial happy, happy, happy all the time, that's not life in the first place. And when you get right down to it, because I see the people every day when they're nearly dying, that doesn't work when it comes to religion or spirituality, whatever. I told her to keep going, keep searching, because he was searching for her. And the unrest that she felt, that I think he's referring to, is that she can't find the peace and the rest. And so I really think every church denomination is going through that. Mm-hmm. I think it's something in all denominations, and I deal with all sorts of denominations. I said, but it's the same God. It's the one you're looking for. He calls you to worship him. And I said, you know, in the last chapter of Revelation, it talks about true worship coming back. And I said, there is such a thing as vain worship and false worship and all of those things. I said, you can look those up and study those. I can give a Bible study in the hospital, you know. But I said, it's just interesting to me in those last few chapters of Revelation, in a period of time that sounds like the end of time, they're talking a lot about worship. And I said, this division is something to bring you to think this through.
Very good. And Revelation does talk a lot about worship, but boy, we must, you know, we should understand that worship is a relationship. It's a one-on-one. It's not found in a building. It's not found in a denomination. It's not found. It's a one-on-one experience where you get that rest from. And this is exactly what Paul's talking about in Hebrews. This was very familiar to the Jews, because they, in their history, Numbers 13 and 14th chapters, was vividly read over and over. And this is where they were up and ready to go into the promised land. And they sent 12 spies. And 10 of them came back and said what?
Bad.
We can't do it. We can't do it. They got big guys in that town. And they look mean. And we can't do it. Now think about that. Here was a God who delivered them as slaves from the most powerful nation at the time, Egypt, had led them through a wilderness, had clothed them. Do you know that we're told that their feet in the wilderness for 40 years never even had bruises on them? Fed them, clothed them, talked to them, took care of them. Miracle after miracle was given. Water came when they needed it, over and over. And they get right to the borderland of the promised land, and they said, we can't do it. Pardon me?
That was before the 40 years when the 12 spies went.
Yes.
So they hadn't, you know, they hadn't gone the experience with the manna and their shoes not wearing out and all of that at that point. They were just maybe 40 days out of Egypt at that point.
Well, let's see if this would be kind of a big miracle.
I mean, the parting of the Red Sea and stuff, sure. Oh,
yes.
But
and they were fed because they ran out of food in 7 days.
Yeah, they were had manna.
Yeah, they ran out of food in 7 days. So they were fed, they were clothed, they had seen all of this.
They were protected from the heat in the daytime.
Absolutely.
And they built the sanctuary and had
see. So they came up and they said, we can't do it. Why did they say that?
Well, they couldn't.
Because they couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were right.
Yeah. Been,
and why were they right?
Because, well, they couldn't
do it. They didn't trust God.
That's exactly correct. They couldn't do it on their own power. They had no trust in God. And that's what God is looking for in His people. And this is what He's saying in Hebrews 4 and in Revelation 14. if you go on your own rest, if you think you can find rest on your own, there is no rest. And when we think we can obtain salvation on our own through our efforts, there is no rest. You have to wholly trust on God. And finally, there was a group of Israel that trusted. And how did they take that big city? Just marched around it, hollered, blew some trumpets, and broke some pitchers. That's the same way we get salvation. It's not by going to church, not reading a bunch of rules and regulations, making sure we study our Sabbath school lesson 7 times during the week. None of that. We obtain salvation when we sit back and let God do the work by accepting Him. As Oswald Chambers says, which is one of my favorite quotations, there is nothing to salvation. God does all the work. Yes, ma'am.
I think we can take that a step further. It just, life throws so much at us sometimes. And there's so many things that we can't deal with. We really don't know what to do. We don't know how to deal with things. And it's just that simple, I think, in those situations in life. Let God deal with some of these things, and we try to do it on our own so often. It's just sometimes it's mundane things, but we're overwhelmed. And I think we don't give life, just day-to-day life, over like it should. It's not just salvation, but every day, all day long.
Okay, very good. And if you put your faith and trust and you rest in God, does that mean everything's going to work out to be just hunky-dory?
No, but you're not
anymore. Ask Peter, who went to the cross. Ask of these martyrs who sang hymns as they would be burning to the stake. Some of the most closest friends of God died for Him. No, yes. But where was their rest? How can a man be burning at the stake, be singing hymns and praising God? That rest does not come upon his actions. It comes on the one who created him. Because he understands in that rest, his eternity, his relationship is assured. And this is the third angel's message. If you put your rest into God, the outcome in the book of Revelation is very simple. Eternal life, a crown of victory. If you put your rest in your own actions, your own efforts, in rebellion or trying to get to heaven through your own actions, that is the height of unrest, because you're never happy. You never can attain it. Any questions? So that's why I think rest is important. All right, let's go down to 14. We're going to talk about the reaping. Somebody read verse 14, please. 14, 14.
Then I looked and behold a white cloud, and sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand.
Okay. Son of man, we know that through the Old Testament. Jesus referred to him. This is Christ. What does golden crown mean?
Victory.
Golden crown to the Romans. And remember, the Romans were in charge. Meant victory. So here comes victory. Revelation is full of good news about victory, victorious people. Then another angel came out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice in him who sat on the cloud, "Put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe." and he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. In any harvest, from the sanctuary time on, there was always what we call the first fruits. At the resurrection of Christ, there were people from the time of Adam on through that were raised at the same time as Christ was raised. And they ascended to heaven. These were the first fruits, the sheave offering. So here Christ comes down, he's reaping the harvest, and he brings the ones that are faithful to him. Now somebody read 17.
Another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel who had charge of the fire came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine, because the grapes are ripe."
Keep going.
The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, so let's get to what in the world's this second angel reaping. Wine press. In the Jewish time, a wine press was made out of bricks, or was a lot of times cut out from a rock. And it was always slightly slanted. And the grapes were put at the top of the wine press, and then people got in with their feet, and they would trample on the grapes, and then the juice would flow down to the bottom. So here again, we were going to go to Matthew 25, but we're running out of time. When Christ came in Matthew 25, what did he say? There was two groups. What were the groups?
Sheep and goats.
What did he say about the goats? By the way, what was the basis of this judgment? What did the sheep do?
Follow,
but what did they do? What was their actions? Pardon?
They heard his voice and knew who he was.
Okay. Well, let's go to 25. Not going to read it, but want you to sing. He called the group and he said to them, they said, "Lord," to the goats, "we've done everything you've ever asked." And he says, "Well, let me see. When I was naked, what did you do? You didn't clothe me. When I was sick, what did you not do? All right. Now, I was hungry, what did you not do? You didn't feed me." He went through all of these things, and what was their answer?
Well, they wouldn't lie at that point. They did those things. They said, "Well, we've done those things."
Yeah. Nope. Yeah. See? What did Jesus say to the righteous people?
Well, he said to those people who said that they had done those things, he said, "Well, I don't know you.
So depart from me." The righteous people didn't even realize they had done those things. "Well, we never did this unto you." And what did he say? "How you treat your brother is the basis of judgment, because how you treat your brother reveals what relationship you have with me." Okay? So here we have in Revelation two separate harvesting, reapings. One is the good one. This one's the bad one. Put them into wine press. Now what do we do with this statement that says, "And the wine press was trodden outside the city, and blood came up to the wine press, up from the wine press, up to the horses' bridles for a distance of about 200 miles. What does outside the city mean? Pardon? Okay, but what did it mean to the Jews who read it in this day? If you go back to Jeremiah and Isaiah, and you go to Joel, judgment was always considered outside Jerusalem. So the metaphors were, if you were in Jerusalem, you were saved. If you were outside Jerusalem, you're unsaved. So they said many times, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Joel, that the judgment comes from outside, meaning that in their interpretation was the Gentiles and the heathen nations, because if you were outside the city, you were going to face judgment. And so John's using this same, that's why he says that the wine press is for the outside the city. If you're not in the New Jerusalem, you're outside the city. How about blood up to the horse's bridle? That's not a very nice thought to think of. Where in the world do you think that came from?
I mean, just to be a big devastation.
Okay.
It's going to be okay. Bad.
This was written in AD 95. Approximately, 95, 96. What happened in AD 70 to the Jews?
They're taken into captivity by Rome.
Okay.
And their city was destroyed.
And what were we told by Josephus and some of the other writers?
Blood flowed.
In the streets.
In the street, how high? Up to the horse's bridle. So can you imagine the devil? Remember, these people fought by sword. They just didn't drop big bombs. They fought by sword. Can you imagine what it was like? They said that the historians say it ran up to the horses' bridles. So this is exactly when you're writing this to Jews, Christians, do you think they understood what that meant? Outside the city, they knew exactly what that meant. Horse's bridle, they knew exactly what that meant. It happened 25 years ago. The distance of about 200 miles, nobody knows what that is. Probably the only thing that makes halfway good sense is from one tip of Palestine to the other tip of Palestine is about 200 miles. So it could be just simply a way of saying, if you're not in and out, just death. So, what's the good news in this?
We don't have to be a part of that destruction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is the good news. You have the choice. We're going through another, I think it's 184,000th episode with our granddaughter again. And 3 months, 4 months ago, she sat right there at that couch and said, "Grandpa, aren't you happy for me?" And I said, "No." And here are the reasons. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this week, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 came to fruition. Now she's shell-shocked. Turns around within 24 hours, goes right back to the same situation. And then just as astonished that, since I won't talk to her, that Grandma is not thrilled. Now, you must understand, we've been going through this now for 7 years, so this isn't an isolated situation. See? But if she does not understand that Grandpa and Grandma are not stupid and have been there before and have some answers that she's never thought of, there's nothing we can do. The good news in this book is it's a book of victory. From the very first verse, it's a revelation of Jesus Christ. And it's all through this. Because the redeemed are there. This, by the way, Revelation 14, the last part, is an answer to Revelation 6, 10, and 11. Remember when the martyrs were being martyred and their blood was splashed? They said, "How long? How long, O God, are you going to let this happen?" This is the answer. Not forever. There will be a day of reckoning. The martyrs who died will weep when the very people that killed them and put them to the stake, when they suffer eternal separation, it will be with sadness that they will be. How dare we paint a picture that we'll walk over and look over the wall and see our worst enemy dying and being burned up and suffering and we'll be happy. No wonder people who have that become agnostics and don't believe in God. I don't blame them. So the book is good news. And this is simply God saying, He started out with the first angel's message saying, respect God, know God, have that relationship, and everything will be fine. But He owes it to us to spell out, if you don't want to do that, then this is what's going to happen. He owes that to us. Nobody will ever stand in the judgment and say, God, well, why didn't you tell me? Because all He'll say with tears in His eyes, my son, my daughter, I spent your entire life telling you. That's why choice is ours. Where we will spend eternity. What a God. What a God. Father in heaven, help us to understand that the choice is very simple. Elijah said it on the mountain. If God is this way, follow Him. If He's not, follow the other way. But you know, Father, in our lives you continue to show your love, your care. You cry when we cry. You laugh when we laugh. But you're always there saying, follow me. Come home. Let's spend eternity together. That's who you are and that's why we love you. Thank you for tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.